So Revelation 6, we've been moving along with the different seals that the Lamb is opening up. And if we remember, he received these from the Father because he's the one that has the authority because he overcame. And he's the only one that could do this. And now what we're seeing is probably the best way I can describe it, is that all the seals follow a consecutive order, but they're concurrent at the same time. Now, what I mean by that is this, is that they all follow each other, but they're all happening at the same time in different ways. So in other words, the first seal that got opened is the white horse. And that's Christ on a white horse going forth conquering with the gospel, right? And then what ends up happening after that are the things like the red horse, which is war. And then we have things like the third seal, which is forced privation. It's not necessarily famine, but it's like forced privation, forced famine, politically motivated, caused by man, not necessarily caused by other things. And that opens up a whole bunch of stuff that we'll be able to dive into. And then you have the fourth seal, which is death and Hades following with him. And what you'll notice is that sometimes these horsemen, these people on the horses, they might be actually evil that God is allowing to go forth and do their job, specifically things like death and Hades. And we'll get into that and how that's used. And then one of the things that's interesting about the death and Hades concept is that Some of the times the people are killed by famine, sometimes with pestilence, sometimes with wild beasts. And then you'll notice with wild beasts, that's a lot of the ways that the Christian martyrs were killed. They were thrown in and had that happen to them. Then you get to the fifth seal, and it's the martyrs. It's like they end up dying through the wild beasts and those types of things. And then they get up into heaven and they say, "How long, O Lord, before you're going to judge and avenge our blood?" And he says, "Hold on." Then the sixth seal, which is the judgment that takes place. So all the seals are they're consecutive, but they're happening kind of at the same time, and they happen repeatedly over again. But there's like a cycle, and it's not a strict cycle, because one of the things that we'll see is that we probably have seen it already, is that with these seals, they're very, very generic. There's not a lot of information about them, right? It's the first one, the white horse, right? He who sat on it with a bow, a crown was given to him, and he went out conquering and to conquer. That's pretty general, isn't it? There's not a ton of information there. And that's what happens with these seals. There's not a lot of information, which lets you know it's not talking about a specific event that is to be pinpointed. Although a lot of people love to try to go back and find, this is what this seal is talking about. Well, you can go back through a lot of history and say, this is what that seal's talking about. For instance, let's look at the second seal, verse 3. He says, "When he broke the second seal, I heard a second living creature saying, 'Come,' and another red horse went out, and to him who sat on it, it was granted to take peace from the earth, and that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to him." Well, try to pinpoint that. Try to focus on a specific event where peace was taken away from the earth and people killed each other. Because that's all that's said about it. Doesn't that really describe the entire history of humanity? See, so what is God trying to get across with stuff like this? What God is trying to get across with things like this is that he knows this. He's over all of it. So we shouldn't lose our faith as if there's no God. He has forgotten us. He has abandoned us. He's still there. He's still watching. You hear a lot of times, people go through, you know, they go through traumatic things. And I've seen interviews with people, you know, coming out of World War II. Horrible, horrible things. And sometimes the questions are like this. They're like, where's God? Where was God in World War II? What did you want God to do? So it's really easy to say, where's God? What would you like God to do? Well, stop the war. Do you recognize what has to happen for God to stop a war? It's not that he's not powerful enough to do it, but he has to do something that he's never done before, which is violate a human's free will. So when you say, where's God, and God needs to stop something horrible that's happening, what we're really saying is that God needs to go back on a decision that he made, and God can't change. And this is one of the things I've been talking about this with other folks over the last few weeks for some reason. I don't know, it keeps coming up. There's this big debate between the sovereignty of God and the free will of man, primarily from the Calvinist viewpoint. Never really had a problem with the sovereignty of God versus the free will of man until Calvinism came along, because quite honestly, they worked pretty well in harmony together. So people have a tendency to think, okay, God is sovereign, and he is, which means he determines everything. Calvinism had a really, really bad, has had a bad spell lately. Thanks to, how many of you have heard of a guy named R.C. Sproul? A lot of you heard of R.C. Sproul. Well, he's been dead for a while now, and he's got his progeny, R.C. Sproul Jr. And I don't know if you heard about what happened with all of that, but he did more to destroy his dad's legacy in Calvinism than anybody else, and he did it by pulling the veil back on what Calvinism really is, because he's a hardcore Calvinist, just like his dad. There was a 10-year-old girl who was horribly, horribly abused and was killed. And Calvinists lately have been stating, God ordains everything. And so someone asked them the question, did God ordain this? Well, you know what? I think I've got a screenshot of the quote, because that would be so much better than me actually trying to summarize it. Give me a second here. Oh, I've got all of Jaden's car accident stuff on here. Oh, yep, I got it. So someone made the point that what happened to this little girl was a tragedy. He said, the closest the world has ever come to a tragedy is when a man who had never sinned was tortured to death. Do you believe God ordained that event? So he doesn't believe when innocent children die, it's a tragedy. Okay? So when they asked him about this and this specific event, here's what he says. Comparing Christ's death to this little girl, 10-year-old girl. And I won't even tell you, because we got little ones in here. I won't even tell you what happened to her, but it's the worst possible things that you can imagine. So he's comparing what happened to her to what happened to Christ. He says, no, it does not remotely compare. Because in one instance, a little girl received the judgment from God she had earned. In the other, a perfect man received the judgment I earned. He says the 10-year-old little girl deserved and earned what happened to her. That's Calvinism, folks. I don't care how you spin it, that's Calvinism. God ordains everything. Do you want to know why Calvinism believes this little girl earned what happened to her? It's because God decided to give her Adam's sin. And because she was born a sinner, she earned what she got because she was imputed with somebody else's sin. That's Calvinism in a nutshell. So, this big debate between the sovereignty of God and the free will of man. See, what actually happened to that poor little girl is a tragedy, because God had no part in causing that to happen. So it brings up the question, why did it happen? doesn't God have the ability to stop things? Well, sure he does. God sovereignly chose, before he said, let there be light, he sovereignly chose that mankind would have free will. That you and I would have choice to make the decisions that we were going to make, and that he would not violate those decisions. When God makes a decision, he is not like another human being who can change their mind. Matter of fact, the scripture says that God does not change his mind. He is the same yesterday, today, and forever. He is absolutely rigid in the way that he operates. There is, no, you got to understand this. There is zero flexibility with God. And you want that. You want to know why you want that? Because you want to know where you stand. Because of the stakes, we're talking about eternal stakes. You want to know where you stand at any given time. You don't want the eternal arbiter and judge of the universe, of your soul, to have a bad day or to change his course midstream. You don't want that. What if he said, okay, this is what salvation is going to be? And then he changes his mind. And you're lost. What if he just decides one day, you know what? I want to see what happens if the earth stops rotating. I want to see what happens if gravity stops for a day. Wouldn't that be fun? Or what if gravity's reversed? Instead of pulling you down, it pushes you away. Wouldn't that be interesting? You see my point? You want someone who's absolutely rigid. You want someone whose moral standards don't change. And you want someone who will never go back on his decision. And the point is that that is the character of God. So you want to know what's great? When he says that he has sent his son to die for the sins of humanity so that whoever has faith in Jesus Christ and obeys the gospel is forever saved by that faith, you can trust it to the death. How awesome is that? See, he is eminently trustworthy because he cannot change. He cannot go back on a decision that he has made. So what that means is, where was God in World War II? Where he's always been. He will not violate the free will of humanity. But he does give people an opportunity to be saved on an individual basis. So that even if they do go through something horrible, they then have eternity with him in glory. I'll take that trade-off. Because the alternative is not good. To not really have free will, that's a bad situation. Because you're a slave. You don't have an opportunity to change anything. But God has made it so that he can be the just judge. I mean, think about how unjust is it for God to punish somebody for a way that he caused them to be and that they have no ability to get out of? It makes no sense. You know, let's go to Psalm 81 for a second. I know this is a bit of a segue, but this is going to make a lot of sense when we get to it. Psalm 81. This is God talking about him bringing his people out of Egypt and then how they rebelled against him. And he says in verse 11, because he said, you know, don't worship any strange gods. He said, but verse 11, he says, but my people did not listen to my voice and Israel did not obey me. So I gave them over to the stubbornness of their heart to walk in their own devices. See, they didn't believe, so God gave them over to the way they wanted to be. He didn't change them. But then look at the next verse, 13. Oh, that my people would listen to me, that Israel would walk in my ways. Why would he say that? Why would he have this longing plea to lay it out there? Oh, that my people would listen to me. And that they'd walk in my ways, when he's the one that has control over all of that, if the Calvinist is true. How silly is that? It'd be like me complaining that a table that I have wobbles when I made it to wobble. And I have control over the wobbling. That'd be kind of silly, wouldn't it? Or if I purposely poked a hole in my roof right above my chair, and then I'm complaining that it's raining and dripping on my head, when I purposely did it. Silly, right? But that's kind of what Calvinism is. So when it comes to war, let's go back to Revelation 6. Notice what it says. It says in another, verse 4, another and a red horse went out, and him who sat on it, and it was granted to take peace from the earth, that men would slay one another, and a great sword was given to them. In other words, what he's talking about is giving people over to what it is that they want to do anyway. Does humanity need any help committing atrocities? Does humanity need any help being angry with each other and going after each other in war? No. They don't have any problems with it at all. And so what ends up taking place is God says, okay, whatever restraining influence I had, it's going to be taken out of the way. And maybe that just means leaders arise that are war hungry. I mean, Pharaoh was put into a position for the Exodus, very special position, because God needed somebody who was exceptionally stubborn. The people of Israel at that time were handpicked to be there so that you could have a people that would see all of the miraculous things that they saw and yet still rebel. It takes a special person to do that. Judas was handpicked to be the son of perdition because of Judas's own free will to walk with Christ for 3.5 years. He actually performed miracles, saw all the miracles that Christ did, and yet still betrayed him. It takes a special person to do that. God didn't make Judas do that. Judas did it on his own. But God, looking through history, he didn't pick you. And he didn't pick me for that job. Why? Because we wouldn't have done it. How do I know we wouldn't have done it? Because here we are, 2,000 years removed, not seeing any of those things, and yet we still serve him in the realm of faith. That means if we would have been there in the realm of sight, we absolutely wouldn't have betrayed him. So this second seal for war really just simply represents that God orchestrates things in the sense of history, causes people to rise, causes people to fall. But evil people are going to get into positions of authority and they're going to want to conquer other people. That's really the way it's been. I mean, think about the world before the flood. There's a specific word that's used there that's not used very often, where he says that the whole earth was full of violence. Violence. It's a very special word. And it's actually stated that every thought was evil continually from their youth. And they lived to be like 900 years, and they were really smart. You think about how evil people get in the 60, 70, 80 years that they have here. Imagine if, you know, you still had 800 years left, and you're a whole lot smarter. Think about how evil people could be. I mean, I would not have wanted to live during that time frame at all. That to me sounds horrific. But what he's talking about here in Revelation 6 with the second seal is the natural outcome of how people are. It's just the way it is. And God is not going to violate free will to stop every bad thing from happening, because the consequence of that, of us not having free will, is horrific. And think about it. If we actually lived in a world that if I was going to do something bad, God automatically stopped me, would it change my heart or mind at all? I would actually be more inclined to do bad things, because I know, number one, either he's going to stop me and it isn't going to happen, or number two, I really want to rebel against him even more. That's not going to work. So, questions, comments before we move on? Alrighty, let's keep going. Third seal. It says, when he broke the third seal, I heard the third living creature saying, come. And I looked, and behold, a black horse. And he who sat on it had a pair of scales in his hand. And I heard something like a voice in the center of the four living creatures saying, a quart of wheat for a denarius and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. And do not damage the oil in the wine. So this third seal, a lot of people think it's famine, because that might be what your heading says, famine. But if you actually look at this, it's not really famine. So he had a pair of scales in his hand. Now that's where you weigh out things for purchase. That's how they used to do it. And then there was a voice that said, a quart of wheat for a denarius and 3 quarts of barley for a denarius. Now, both of those measurements are about what it takes for food for a day for a person. Now, what's a denarius? It's a day's wage. If you've got the amount of food you need for a day, costing what it takes for you to work for a day, you're talking about a hand-to-mouth existence, right? I mean, a lot of us aren't in that position. There are people in the world who are in that position, but you know, most people are not. And so someone might say, well, yeah, that looks like famine written all over it. Well, not quite, because if you look at other places where famine was in existence, prices were way higher than that. But this is also how you know it's not famine. Look what he says. Do not damage the oil and the wine. You mean something's going to impact the wheat and the barley, but the grapes are going to be just fine? I can see the olive trees being okay. You know, they got deep roots and stuff. But, you know, vineyards, grapes need really special care to be able to exist. Changes in weather, you know, I mean, if you think about it, you can only grow those things in certain places, in certain conditions. What this is talking about is that the oil and the wine were more of the luxuries of life. And what God is saying is that the luxuries are going to be just fine, because the rich aren't going to take their luxuries off the table. And the rich can afford the prices of the wheat and the barley and have plenty, because they're going to be able to do just fine. So what this is really talking about is, what I think it's talking about is forced privation. And if you think about it, what ends up a lot of times taking place, famines do happen. Don't get me wrong. Famines do take place where people really, really struggle to exist. But a lot of times when you have subjugation like that, or when you have food shortages like this, a lot of times they're politically motivated. I mean, we see it in our day and age quite a bit. I mean, what happened in Ukraine when the communists under Stalin, after the communist revolution took place? The farmers didn't want to give up their land to the state communes, to the state-owned farms. So what did they do? They starved them out. Millions of people died of starvation in Ukraine. That's what happened. You know, when I was growing up in the 80s, there was a big thing about Ethiopia and the famines that were taking place there. They had food. If you go back and study that out, a lot of those places had food. It was the government that was keeping it from being distributed. To make it worse, they utilized these types of things to take place. I mean, in our own history, go back and look what happened to the Shenandoah Valley when the North came through. Burned everything out. See, if you can destroy the food crop, you can control the people. You know, one of the things that invading armies used to do back in the old days, they used to sow the fields with salt to make it so that nothing would grow. And they wouldn't be able to have any food going forward. No way to get it. This is what this is talking about. It's talking about essentially, and I'm not trying to play class warfare here, but the Bible does let us know that the rich persecute the poor. It is what happens. So let's actually head over to James chapter 2. Let's look at verse 1. He says, my brethren, do not hold your faith in our glorious Lord Jesus Christ with an attitude of personal favoritism. For if a man comes into your assembly with a gold ring and dressed in fine clothes, and there also comes in a poor man in dirty clothes, and you pay special attention to the one who's wearing the fine clothes and say, you sit here in a good place, and you say to the poor man, you stand over there or sit down by my footstool, have you not made distinctions among yourselves and become judges with evil motives? Listen, my beloved brethren, did not God choose the poor of this world to be rich in faith and heirs of the kingdom which he promised to those who love him? But you have dishonored the poor man. Is it not the rich who oppress you and personally drag you into court? Do they not blaspheme the fair name by which you have been called? What's James saying? There's issues here, right? There's been a lot of renewed emphasis, and I think properly, on the damage that debt and interest does to people and does to an economy. Now, we did some study on this way back. I believe it was when we were in Romans 13. You can go back on the website. Go under the Romans section and go to Romans 13 and the section where we talked about, oh, nothing to no one except to love one another. I did a whole bunch of stuff there on debt, on the concept of what kind of damage debt and interest does to people and to a society. But suffice it to say, our world runs on debt. It runs on interest. And it's damaging to the very core of a society. When God created a government, he made a distinct ordinance in the law that said every 7 years, every debt is erased and every land holding goes back to its original owners. Because God knew that debt like this destroys people. It creates an immoral society because if I can borrow money and not have to work to get it, it creates an immoral individual potentially. There's a lot of people that, you know, they get wealthy off of debt. They're like, I'm just going to use it. I'm just going to use it. I think Christians really need to reconsider this type of a concept. Now, there are some things that you can't buy without debt in our society, because it is just the way that it is. Good luck trying to buy a house without getting into debt. It's not possible. Mortgages didn't used to exist. Did you know that? In our society, in our country? And when they did, the prices of homes went up. Anytime money becomes cheap and easy to get, anytime something gets subsidized, costs go up. It's why your grocery bills are high. It's why home prices are high. It's why car prices are high. There is no reason a car should cost $50,000. It's ridiculous. The reason it is because you can borrow against, you can finance it for 8 years. That's why. You want to know why medical bill, Jaden just got a huge medical bill for 2 hours in the ER. Now it's okay, insurance is going to take care of that. But why is the medical bill so high? Because of the insurance. That's why. Why is college so expensive? Because of student loans. Okay, you go back and look at these things. There is an absolute correlation to the increase in prices and the ability to have it debt financed or to have it subsidized. 1,000%. God knew what he was doing. And so my point is that, you know, there's not a lot we can do about certain things. We need places to live. We need, a car is a necessity today. We don't live in societies where you could, you know, go a few blocks, go to the market, you know, take your horse back home and everything's all fine. You know, I couldn't do what I do if I didn't have a car. I need to go to Harrisonburg. You know, you need to be able to get around. A lot of you have commutes for work. I know my boys, you know, drive almost an hour each way to go to work. Can't do it without a car. It's a necessity. So a lot of things today, you can't buy without debt. My point is, a society that's built on that is enslaved. And they are subject to the whims of the people who own the debt. Now, they've got a fine line to walk because they could become, you know, more increasingly oppressive, but then they cut off the hand that feeds them, right? They need to walk that fine line of making debt affordable, but not so unaffordable where you can't get it anymore. It's a fine line between that. But without getting too conspiratorial, you got to be careful these days. I could put the tinfoil hat on and go off on this stuff. What's that? Go ahead. Oh, no, I'm not. There really is a small group of people way up at the top that use these things to control everything. Like ChatGPT and I got into a debate and talking about what caused World War II. And I asked it the question about the Rothschilds. Oops. Being the, you know, the bankers for the nations. They were the ones that controlled all the debt. And ChatGPT was saying, oh, they're just benign, harmless people who just were at the service of the countries to, you know, to help them finance. I said, hold on a second. How much debt did they finance for these countries, and why did they finance it? And he would say, well, a lot of it was for war. I'd say, oh, so there's a profit motive for war? I'd say, yes. And it was surprisingly honest, and it said, yes, war can be quite profitable for the sovereign bankers who are over the nations. Huh. I said, so let me ask you a question. Do you think they exercised any political control over the government, seeing that they were the ones providing debt for the war? It would not go there with me. It says, no. Go back and research it. Go back and research the Treaty of Versailles, what happened with Germany during those time frames. Because I was actually talking to my sister and my brother-in-law about this when they were here for a visit last week. That's where it came from. And I was saying, how in the world could a guy like Hitler rise up and people listen to him? How, I mean, Did he start off crazy and people were just like, yeah, let's kill people. Let's take a whole group of people and exterminate them. Let's do that. No, that just doesn't happen. But when you have a people that are beaten down, beaten down, beaten down, beaten down through the Treaty of Versailles, and somebody comes up and says, and if you go back and listen to his earlier speeches, he doesn't sound super crazy. He's just trying to build some pride back in the people. Now, he was crazy. They just didn't realize it yet. So I don't want anyone thinking, because somebody could really take that out of context, you thought you like him. No, I don't. He's a crazy madman. And he's, you know, after he died a natural death in Argentina, he probably... I'm just kidding. I don't know if that's the case. I'm just saying, I know the conspiracy theories are out there on that kind of stuff. I don't... What, Brian? Oh, Argentina declassified that? Did that happen? He died in 62? Y'all are crazier than me. That's great. I'm in good places. According to their documents, really? I did not know that. So, oh, come on, Chad. Y'all crazy. So apparently, for those who couldn't hear on the feed, Argentina declassified documents supposedly, and Hitler actually died in Argentina in 1962. That's interesting. And Chad said Hitler was a Rothschild. Look it up. So I mean, so we've got fellow conspiracy theorists here. I don't know. It's not a conspiracy theory. That's right. It's not a conspiracy theory if you have the evidence. But anyway, come back. My point is that, you know, a guy like Hitler doesn't just get traction out of nowhere, and they don't just come out talking the crazy stuff that they talk out of the gate. They don't. My point is the reason he was received. If you go back and look at it, it's because of the financial condition of the world at that time and who was in control of the financial condition of the world at that time. That's all I'm trying to say. In other words, people have a tendency to stop at the first level of crazy. You need to peel back the curtain sometimes and go back. And I think Revelation does a really good job of letting us know that the conspiracy theories go deep. I don't know how you can be a Christian and not believe in a conspiracy. There's one conspiracy theory that every Christian should believe in, that Satan is conspiring to destroy the work of Christ on this earth and has been ever since he fell. And he will use whatever's possible. So you pull back the curtain of any crazy thing that's going on out there today, and you will find demonic forces over and above that. I believe every Christian should be able to agree on that if we don't agree on, you know, the minutiae and all these other things. This black horse is talking about inflation, manipulation, because inflation is another form of taxation and debt. Your dollar is worth less today than it was yesterday. Your dollar will be worth less tomorrow than it is today. That's just a fact. It's just how it works. Our national debt has increased $2 trillion since January. We're over $38 trillion now. I thought this was going to stop. I know there's attempts to try to make it stop, but it's not necessarily working super well. I don't know if it can, because I don't know who has the ability to make stuff like that stop. It's not really our government that has that ability, because they're in debt and enslaved. That's the fact. So go back and listen to those messages. I won't hearken on that anymore or ride that any further. But the one thing I want to end with Hebrews chapter 10. What This is really depressing, right? This is pretty horrible. I'll tell you what. Hebrews chapter 10 does a really good job of helping us see the whole picture of this. Let's look at verse 32. Now, the writer of Hebrews is talking to Jewish Christians who are thinking about leaving Christianity and going back into Judaism, and they faced a lot of persecution when they became Christians. He says in verse 32, "But remember the former days, when after being enlightened, you endured a great conflict of sufferings, partly by being made a public spectacle through reproaches and tribulations, and partly by becoming sharers with those who were so treated. For you showed sympathy to the prisoners." They were imprisoned for their faith. "And accepted joyfully the seizure of your property, knowing that you have for yourselves a better possession and a lasting one. Therefore, do not throw away your confidence, which has a great reward. For you have need of endurance, so that when you have done the will of God, you may receive what was promised. For yet in a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one shall live by faith, and if he shrinks back, my soul has no pleasure in him. But we are not those who shrink back to destruction, but those who have faith to the preserving of the soul." So let's think about what these Jewish Christians were facing. They were made public spectacles. They were drug out, made public spectacles, tribulations, persecutions, and then you had other Jewish Christians who would stand up and defend them. You had people who were going to prison for their faith. And their property was being seized. They would come to their home and tell them, "You no longer have a home. It's gone. Get out. I don't know where you're going to go, but it's not here." And they would go and they would live with other saints. And what's the writer of Hebrews telling them? Suck it up. Endure. Persevere. And he's telling them something else, though, that's going to help them with the perseverance. He says, you need to understand. And you knew this at one time. He's telling these guys this. You knew this at one time. You have a better possession and a lasting one. You know what? Those people lived people he's talking to, they lived 2,000 years ago. They've been dead for 2,000 years. And if they died in faith, do you know where they've been? In their better and more lasting possession. Way longer than they ever suffered here on earth. You think those who were faithful in this type of an environment are really happy now that they were? And what about the ones that went back, denied their faith, got back into their home, were outstanding members of the community, and they've been dead for 2,000 years, and they've been in the other place? Do you think they wish they could go back and do it all over again and endure it? Yeah. I would add one thing to what the writer here says when he says you have need of perseverance or endurance. Perseverance. I would also add this. We have need for perspective. We need to have the right perspective of what this world is about and what God has in store for us and what we're here for. Perspective. We need to recognize that we're not here to be comfortable. We're here to be faithful. Comfort many times is an enemy of faithfulness. Wealth gets in the way of this frequently, which is why in Revelation 6, when he's talking about this black horse, he's letting you know this is going to happen. You can compromise and try to chase that physical prosperity. But I hope what this country is showing you now and what the world is showing you now is that it's becoming increasingly out of reach. And we could take a step back and say and lament and be sad about it, or we can rejoice in our eternal home and be absolutely faithful and not compromise. I know what my physical future holds. It's not much. I'm not going to be prosperous. I'm not going to be wealthy. I made a choice. I gave that up a while ago. If I never own, I mean, I don't own a home now. If I never own a home again, I am 1,000% okay with that. Because I have an enduring home. I have a lasting residence. And it's better than anything this world could ever possibly provide for me. And so do you. We just got choices to make. What are we going to live for? What are we going to focus on? Are we going to be those who shrink back to destruction? Or those who have faith for the preserving of our eternal souls? Eternity is a long time, isn't it? This physical life is very short. I'm 53. I'm not as old as some of y'all. But I'm moving up there. I might have 20 years left. I mean, if my family history is anything, I'm due for a major heart attack within the next 2 years. I'm okay with that. Now I've taken a lot better care of myself than other males in my family. So hopefully that helps. But if I'll live as long as God wants me to, and when I'm done, I'm dead. That's the bottom line. When God's done with you, you're dead too. And if you're in Christ, that's an awesome thing, man. You're going to go to your everlasting reward. And this little vapor of a life, why would we trade our souls for this vapor of a life? Who cares if we have physical prosperity? Who cares if we have wealth? Who cares if we have comfort? We're here to work. We're here to push. We're here to be with Christ in that first white horse on that first seal, who's going out conquering and to conquer. We're with him. Let's go do it. Questions or comments as we wrap up?